Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick, he's Dan, and we're joined by a man who needs no introduction on this podcast any longer. The last podcast, wrapping up the season, Brian Snow is with us once again. Guys, glad to have you back. Dan, lots of stuff to get to, but first, this is the 26th edition. What do you got for me?
I'm going to defer to Snow on this.
Without question, this is the Willie Mopeña edition. Maybe the greatest red in history, who hit the farthest home run I have ever seen in my life.
He hit a walk-off on his bobblehead night against the Rays. That was like the only good thing that happened that entire season in whatever it was, 04 or 05.
All I remember is I'm sitting in college, and he hit one to the top corner towards center field of the bleachers.
Wait,
you cannot hit a baseball further than that. It's impossible.
You were sitting in college. Does that mean you were at a Reds game while the rest of your class was sitting in college? Or describe that situation for me. What did you mean by that?
It was a Saturday afternoon. I was on the third floor of my place with my pit bull, Houday, and we were watching the game.
So, Rick, I don't want to step in the middle of this, but since the last time we spoke, Musketeers beaten 58-57 in the first round of the Atlantic 10 tournament at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. That was on the 14th of March. Musketeers finished the season at 17-14. There was some thought that they might have a shot at an NIT bid, but that did not come to fruition. The Musketeers declined the opportunity to play in the CBI, or I guess maybe the CIT, although that usually wouldn't invite an Atlantic 10 team. And the season ends 17-14 is the bottom line. And we head into a critical off season for the Musketeers program. A lot of the changes that are going to be made are already in place. We know all about the newcomers on the roster. We now know that Greg Christopher, former AD at Bowling Green, will be stepping into Mike Babinski's shoes as the new AD at Xavier, and a new conference. Where do we start?
Well, I think we could start, first of all, with the new AD, Greg Christopher, being introduced today. I don't know. Maybe Snow can jump in if there's anything he can add after I'm done here. But as of 2 weeks ago, it was Thor Bjorn. I had that through pretty good sources, and clearly I wasn't the only one reporting it. We had newspapers in Rhode Island reporting that. We had people here reporting that. And it just didn't pan out for whatever reason. About last week, I started getting information that Greg Christopher was now the likely candidate to get the job, and so it was. He said that Babinski had talked to him a month ago while Babinski was putting together a short list for Father Graham, and then he finished wrapping up the hiring process on Friday, this past Friday. So that's sort of the timeline there. I don't know what changed, what happened, if anything happened, or if we just got bad information on Thor Bjorn, but things changed quickly somehow.
Yeah, I would say the information was correct on Thor Bjorn based on kind of what I found out afterwards. That said, no idea what changed. All I heard was Greg Christopher came in and beat him out. Now, how you beat someone out after the decision's been made, that's above my pay grade, but that's what I was told. The one thing that I'm told Greg Christopher brings to the table is he's an excellent fundraiser, where if you were going to put a check minus on Mike Babinski's career at Xavier, fundraising would certainly not be his strength as an athletic director. I'm told this is Greg Christopher's strength, so I think that's something they kind of looked at, and maybe something different that he's going to bring to the table that a Mike Babinski did not, whereas he might not be as strong in other areas that Mike was very strong in. You know, we all have our strengths and weaknesses. I'm told that's a specific strength of his and something the university did like.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, Snow, is really until we get into him making hires and we see him hire a new basketball coach at some point if he has to do that, I don't know that there's really going to be a way for him to compare to Mike Babinski, because for the most part, I think what fans really like about Mike was that he made three excellent basketball hires, and then the other part of it was in the public eye, he was very smooth, was a great interview, he gave a good first impression to everyone upon meeting them, and then of course he put Xavier in the forefront with the selection committee work that he did, and I think Christopher's very similar in the sense that he's very polished as a public speaker. He's going to come off well in first impressions in public, and I'm sure he'll do all that he can. He's already worked on the selection committee as well, and that's how he knew Mike. So I think really until he gets to the point of making a hire, people are going to feel pretty good about this hire. Would you agree with that for the most part?
I mean, I would hope so. Granted, I don't know what the heck an athletic director really does outside right. of, you know, like the hiring part. You know, it's just not what I do. They run an athletic department. I have no idea what that means. So I would assume people will be happy because there's quite honestly nothing they would see that would get screwed up. So I don't see how people could be like, oh, I don't know. You know, we don't like this Christopher guy. Like, you don't know what he's actually doing. So I think everyone's going to be fine and dandy unless he hires somebody that they don't like.
Well, as we look now, guys, at the 2012-2013 season in retrospect, I think there are two prisms you can analyze this season through. Number one, you can sort of look at it from an objective standard. You can say, how did this season match up to recent Xavier history to – relatively distant Xavier history, and or you can say, well, let's look at the specific circumstance of this year and how did the team perform compared to what the reasonable expectations would be under those circumstances. And the best analogy I could think of as I was thinking about this today was like, if I go out and play golf and I shoot a 90, that's pretty bad compared to like the objective standard of what par is. But for me, being a complete hack, that's a pretty good score. And so this year it seemed like one of those years where, yeah, 17-14, not a good win-loss record by Xavier standards. The RPI, the Sagarins, everything, the KenPom, tempo-free statistics were all pretty bad compared to the standard of the program, say, for the last decade. But by the same token, when you consider the specific things that happened around the program starting last summer, how would you guys say the team performed in that, what's the word I'm looking for, in that context?
For me, I would say they slightly exceeded my expectations for the team coming into the year. That's not to say things were perfect. That's not to say they executed the way they should have all the time. But I felt that they slightly exceeded what I thought they would be in a very tough A-10 this year. Now, granted, they had some benefits of the schedule in terms of who they played home and who they played road. But overall, I felt the development of Travis Taylor was huge. Samaje Christen was very good. The development of Isaiah Fillmore as the season went on. I mean, that's the thing that people don't understand. Isaiah Fillmore was not running at the start of practice, or maybe like 2 days before practice he got cleared or something. I mean, he was so limited all offseason. Like, they had everything that could go wrong for them in an offseason did. And when that happens – for me to see them win 17 games, finished what, top 6-7 in the league, depending on tiebreakers. I know it's shook down a certain way. You know, it was a slight overachievement. Was it great? No. Was it good? Yeah. But, you know, it was a slight overachievement from my perspective.
Yeah. I guess the thing I would say about this season is they did about all they could do. To me, There were a few games that were really disappointing in the fact that they probably – you look at just a couple of those games and it could have drastically changed what their resume looked like and put them in a greater position to even play in the tournament despite the setbacks that they had to start this year and in the offseason that Brian talked about. But overall, they did everything they could do. This team – we've talked so much about how they didn't have the horses on the offensive end to score with a lot of these other teams, and there was a lot of stop gaps being made at different times by Mac, whether there were injuries or guys going out with cramps. I mean, there was a lot to overcome this year, and I thought they did a good job of handling all those things and still staying competitive in every game that they played in. But at the end of the day, I don't want to sound too positive on this. I mean, it's not like anyone here is sitting here and saying that this is some magnificent coaching job that was so over the top and this team has had a great year. This is below Xavier standards. You know, some things didn't work out for this staff that they thought with recruiting-wise and the way the classes shook out. And obviously, you just couldn't have planned for something like the Dez situation to happen. So I don't think it's a perfect season by any stretch of the imagination. But for the most part, they overachieved and did what they could.
Guys, I wanted to make a couple statistical remarks that sort of bear out what we've talked about. The way that Xavier had to ugly up their game this year, the way that they were able to stay in games with defense and tenacity rather than being the kind of free-scoring, free-flowing team we might have seen in the past. X averaged, and I'm taking these statistics from statsheet.com, X averaged 63.7 possessions per 40 minutes. That's 289th in Division I out of about 350 teams. So that's in the bottom 20%. This was an interesting one. Their field goal attempts, they had 1,582 field goal attempts this year. That's 303rd in Division I, which I think illustrates, and was last in the Atlantic 10, by the or 14th to 16th in the Atlantic 10, by the way. I think that just illustrates how few opportunities they had because they had to slow down the games and because it was such a half-court struggle. Another interesting one, we talked all year about how X didn't utilize the three-point goal. I found it interesting. X ended up shooting 35% from three-point territory this year, which isn't bad. It's in the top third of D1. But they only took 400 three-pointers, and that is 341st out of 346 teams in Division I hoops this year. So that just shows you that this was a team that absolutely never was able to put the kind of three-point shooting performance together that has given that gives a lot of teams a chance in games where they might be overmatched talent-wise. When you look at the defensive statistics, on the other hand, X comes off looking a lot better. But when you talk about those specific issues, they just came up time and time again this year. An inability to control the three-point line, an inability to speed up the game when they had to. And I think it is – I think the team does deserve a lot of credit because they only got blown out a couple times all year. The last game was sort of a microcosm for the season. They were in it. It was a possession-by-possession affair. X wasn't good enough to blow St. Joe's out when they had the opportunity, but they were good enough not to get blown out when St. Joe's made their run. And it came down to the last second. It was a freak play. And unfortunately, X has just not gotten the bounces this year. The bounces or the whistles, and so that last-second attempt by Isaiah Fillmore rims out, and the season's over.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think we should make it clear. The staff absolutely hated having to play the way they did. They never want to do that again. It was too slow. They just hated it. But, you know, you do what you got to do. You know, sometimes the bounces don't go your way. Sometimes the whistles don't go – I mean, what was it? Miller's first year, certainly that team wasn't great, but I think they lost like 8 games at the buzzer basically.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like sometimes crap happens, and this was a crap happens year for Xavier University on the basketball court, and that's what it is.
So let's review the season real fast, do a little lightning round. We'll go around the horn here on a few items. The first thing, let's talk about what the best game of the season was, and we'll split this up and we'll say the best Xavier performance versus the best game period, the most competitive or the most exciting or whatever. Start with you, Rick.
This is tough, but I'm going to go all the way back. I know it's somewhat insignificant, but I'm going to go to that Butler game at the beginning of the year. That was, in my opinion, as good as Xavier played all season long. It was unbelievable defensively, unbelievable tenacity and intensity, and they played pretty well on the offensive end. I mean, they made tough shots, they executed down the stretch, and came out with a huge win early in the season. And though the season didn't quite, you know, play out, I still have to say that's probably their best win when I look back at the full slate of games.
For me, I would say Butler and Butler. The best game Xavier played was Butler to start the season in terms of how they're executed and how they played. I didn't see every Xavier game, so I can't say, you know, which necessarily of all of them. But of the ones I saw both live and in person, I thought the Butler game at Pinkel Fieldhouse was a great college basketball game. Just very entertaining. Guys made plays. I thought that was a great college basketball game.
Yeah, it's hard to argue against the first Butler game as X's best performance of the season. But I want to throw in that LaSalle game into the mix too, because that was a game that X got down 11 or 12 points early and made a huge run and really dusted LaSalle in the second half. I mean, they had them down 20, 21 points before the walk-ons coughed up most of it. And as we've seen, LaSalle, pretty damn good team. They're still playing, unlike all their conference mates. So that would be one that I'd throw into the mix. The best game this year for me, it was not a thing necessarily of beauty, but I there were two that I'll cite. Neither was a thing of beauty, but both were just great competitive games. And those are the home games against Temple and SLU for a little bit different reasons. The SLU game, just because St. Louis is such a good team and because it was such a competitive back and forth game and because I really admired X's bounce back in the overtime after blowing a lead that seemed insurmountable at the end of regulation. The Temple game, because it was one of those games where, again, it was a Murphy's Law type game for X in the second half. They lose D. Davis to that wrist injury with about, I don't know, with about 8 minutes left in the first half, I want to say. And, you know, Samaje had some cramping issues in the second half. And it was just one of those games where it felt like X was hanging on just by their fingernails or just by the skin of their teeth the whole game, and they were able to put it away. So that was one of my favorites of the season.
Yeah, I didn't say my favorite game. I'd say I think Snow hit it on the head that Butler game was the best game of the season at Hinkle, like the most fun to watch. But I thought the VCU game at Xavier was a fun game to watch as well. It didn't turn out all that well for Xavier, but I thought overall, I mean, they made a lot of big shots to stay in that one too and kept it exciting all the way until the final possession.
All right, so best player this year.
There's only one option.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the guy that led the team in, deep breath, minutes, field goals made, field goals attempted, free throws attempted, assists, turnovers, steals, points, pretty much everything. So if we put that guy aside, who was your player of the season besides Samaje Christen?
Oh, Travis Taylor, without question. And obviously, you know, the next thing on the list is most improved player, and I'd say he's also that. You know, Travis Taylor, I don't think people remember quite what was written on my message board a year ago about Travis Taylor. I mean, people wanted him gone. They were talking about him worse than they're currently talking about Justin Martin. It was a rough deal to be Travis Taylor at this time last season. And he was unbelievable. And not only did he have a great year and came so far in terms of his development, but he was a rock. I mean, there were only three, maybe four games that you can pick out throughout the year where he didn't come through when Xavier needed him.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about Travis Taylor is if they grade everybody out defensively, he's probably number five every time he's on the court. So he didn't have a great year, or he had a very good year, but you know, he did. There's some things that were masked there by his stat sheet numbers. I thought D. Davis had a good year, even though his stat sheet numbers might not suggest how good of a year he had. And then I would say Isaiah Fillmore, the second half of the year, was Xavier's second best player.
Yeah, I would say that Taylor improved by leaps and bounds this season. Even from the first half of the season to the second half of the season, because the first half, if you remember, he did have some disappearing acts. The second half of the Vanderbilt game, the second half of the Wofford game, he was pretty much non-existent. Second half, he gave a lot more consistent performance with the caveat that Snow mentioned about the defense. But yeah, Isaiah Fillmore, for me, his growth, and as Brian says, just getting into shape and getting healthy in the second half of the year, he showed the kind of player he is. He started stepping out toward the end of the season, hitting 15-footers the way we knew he could. And I think that his emergence in the last month to 6 weeks of the season really gives me a lot of optimism for X's inside options next year, given that they'll have Stainbrook available and maybe some other guys that we'll talk about later in the show, most likely.
Yeah, there's a few things I'd add about Fillmore real quick. One, I think Mike Pegues deserves a lot of credit here for the way that Fillmore did develop, though, because if you'll remember, he did need time to get back in shape and get his legs back under him and everything, but he was also playing a completely different way on the offensive end to start the year. He started games by waiting for perimeter jump shots to come open and then forcing one when they didn't, and shooting shots off the dribble, fading away from the basket. And then by the middle of the year, or late in the year, when he came around, he was attacking the rim first and foremost, pump faking guys, powering through them for and ones, and scoring off of putbacks and things of that nature, and then going outside and maybe taking a jumper later in the game after he got going. And a lot of that, you know, Mike Piggy's really worked with him as far as, one, his post game went and defending in the post as well, but two, just his getting his confidence going and thinking a little bit differently on the offensive end. I'll also say Byron Larkin had many talks with Isaiah, I know, and, you know, it was just kind of he's a guy who needs encouragement. And Byron was kind of like, you know, when you came here, you said you wanted to play for money. You don't look like a guy who can play for money right now. And really encouraged him to be more aggressive and quit worrying about things about, like, getting taken out or losing his starting minutes or anything like that. And just play. And just play like he knows how and be confident. And I think that really helped him out as the year went on.
By the way, nice mention for Coach Pegues on TV the other day. I was at the gym, and they had the Delaware women's game on TV, on one of the TVs, and there was a discussion about Mike because his career scoring number had been eclipsed by Elaine Deladonna or whatever the basketball player they've got, the women's player is they've got. Let's talk briefly about who was the, you know, we talked about the positive. Let's talk a little bit about the negative. Who's the biggest disappointment this year, and who do you think needs to step up between this year and next?
Once again, only one answer. Justin Martin. I mean, he started off strong. He was the most consistent player, and then all of a sudden he trailed off.
He's definitely was the biggest disappointment this year. And I'd say Isaiah Fillmore for the first half of the year, though it wasn't his fault, I think everyone had high expectations that he would be a guy who could help score on the offensive end, and he just wasn't able to do that. So I'd add him into the mix on disappointments. But again, I don't think it was his fault. I don't think he was physically able to help the team. And then, like Snow said, I mean, it's again Justin Martin. It's going to be crucial that he improve before next season, because Xavier needs minutes and they need scoring production out of him next year.
I was going to say that the most disappointing player for me was Jeff Robinson. And, you know, as with most things, it just comes down to what are your expectations. And I think the Jeff Robinson we saw in the Butler game at the beginning of the year looked like a guy that had finally turned the corner and had finally tapped in to that unbelievable well of talent that he's got. But and we saw glimpses of it from time to time throughout the season. By the end of the season, he had settled more into a relatively solid role player status, but they needed more from him this year. He was the kind of player that could be a difference maker for the team. And, you know, maybe it's unreasonable to expect a guy like that that never really played that much in high school and really got his opportunities more because of God-given talent than anything than his actual accomplishments as a prep player. But, you know, it just never came together for him. And I have no reason to believe that he didn't work hard and that he wasn't out there busting his butt, but, you know, it just didn't come together for him. And I think that hurt. And I think that ultimately that kept the team from making the leap to the next level. And then for improvement, you know, it's Justin Martin, and it's the reasons that you guys just said, that X really doesn't have a built-in option at the three other than Justin next year. And it's absolutely critical that he improve, and especially because his stock in trade is supposed to be outside shooting, and he shot a really poor percentage this year. I mean, he was under 30%, which X just cannot have next year. The next topic that we're going to talk about as we wrap this up is talk a little bit about next year's team and who's the most important newcomer for the Musketeers as we look ahead to the 2013 and 14 season, and there are plenty of guys to choose from.
Yeah. I'm going to start by saying Brandon Randolph. And the more obvious answer is probably Matt Stainbrook, but I'm going to just go ahead and put my faith behind this one and say he's going to be solid at the very worst. I mean, I think he's going to give them a legit post presence, both scoring at least 8 to 10 points a game and rebounding well on the defensive end and defending fairly well. I think he's going to be solid. I'm going to say Brandon Randolph is the most important newcomer for next year, because they will lack scoring pop once again if he's not able to score the basketball. I mean, they're going to be iffy at the three with Justin Martin being the likely returning starter. So I think you need Brandon Randolph to be a legit scoring presence in the backcourt.
For me, I'm going to say Miles Davis for a lot of the reasons you said Brandon Randolph. But to me, like, Miles Davis can be that shooter. And when you have two guys who can score on the low post like Isaiah Fillmore and Matt Stainbrook, when you have a guy who can also space the floor like Miles Davis, who can actually play basketball off of a closeout, I think he could be huge and just open things up in a big, big way. So at Miles Davis making shots and being a real basketball player and not just a guy who makes shots when he's open, I think that's the most important guy coming in next year.
I'm going to say Jalen Reynolds. And the reason that I'm going to say that is because I look at Xavier's big men next year and I see Stainbrook, Fillmore, and a lot of question marks. And X is going to need a third guy, a third and a fourth guy in that rotation to step up and be able to eat minutes. Reynolds has unbelievable athletic capabilities. Now, granted, he's going to be raw, and who knows how he's going to look after a year of enforced idleness, courtesy of the NCAA. But I think he could be a huge asset for this team. And if he can step in and if he can give them rebounding and defense and protect the rim a little bit and not foul so much that he's a liability, I think he could be a huge asset to the team this year, especially for a team that I think is going to want to run a little bit more. And I don't know how well Stainbrook runs the floor, but we know Fillmore is not really an end-to-end type player. So it would be nice to have that option of a four-man that can get up and down the floor.
Well, and he also brings something different from those other two big guys in the sense that he is that longer, more athletic shot-blocking type presence and rebounding presence on the defensive end, which the other two guys are a little bit more offensive-oriented post players and definitely lower, you know, play under the basket a little bit more.
Now we know about the newcomers that we've already talked about, the transfer Stainbrook and the freshmen that are coming in, the guys coming out of their year of ineligibility. But there are still chances that the roster, well, as we learned last summer, the roster in November may not look the same way as the roster in March. I was looking over the roster, and it doesn't seem like there are any obvious candidates of guys that may leave the program this summer. Of course, anything could change. But there are some opportunities for X to add a player or two. They have two free scholarships. What's you guys' sense of the way the staff may go with those two free scholarships over the summer? And do you think I'm wrong? Do you think there's a chance that somebody may be out?
Personally, I can't really see a transfer. The only name that would seem possible would be big game James Farr, but I think he's pretty solid and feels he can get minutes next year with the graduation of Travis Taylor and Jeff Robinson. So I would say no transfers is my guess. In terms of additions, you know, obviously Alexander Vezenkov and Junior Ito are possible. There's some JUCO names popping up. The always popular fifth-year transfer route will start to become apparent here soon. No idea who might or might not be available there. But, I mean, I would say there's a good chance Xavier will try to add somebody, maybe even two guys, especially if one's a fifth-year guy. And we'll see how that goes. I would assume they would look to add a wing, someone with athleticism. But, you know, maybe some, you know, really good point guard pops up and he's too good to pass up. You never really know.
Yeah, I agree with Brian. And I think the biggest thing is going to be that fifth-year transfer. If you remember, before they ended up getting Stainbrook as just a transfer, they went through about four or five different names at least on the fifth-year transfer front that they were involved with and had a couple visits from. And I think you're definitely going to see some more names like that pop up and maybe another JUCO guy or two for the 2013 class still. I don't know that they'll be as likely to add a guy like a Stainbrook who would have to sit out a year, though it's possible. I mean, if the right guy pops up, I'm sure they'll consider it. But like Snow also said, I wouldn't get too caught up in positions here either, because I think the biggest thing next year is just that you're going to have enough talent. You're going to have more horses to do the things you want to do offensively. What you're going to lack is that proven guy, that veteran guy, the guy who's been through the wars a little bit. So I could see them really adding depth and experience at almost any position if it's the right prospect.
Right. And one thing that people probably need to keep in mind is that we are only at the beginning of the silly season as far as coaching, the coaching carousel goes. UCLA is open. USC is still vacant. after Kevin O'Neill did what he does with all his jobs, which is treat it like Sherman treated Atlanta. You've got Minnesota that's open now with the firing of Tubby Smith. And of course, as those jobs are filled, probably, you know, high major, mid-major jobs will come open. So there may be guys back on the market that may be released from an LOI late in the game. So I would think that X would be looking at all avenues, but certainly I think the names that, that Snow mentioned, Bezenkov and Itu, are the ones that we've heard the most about so far. Guys, when I guess we'll wrap this up, talk a little bit about the NCAA tournament so far. Why don't we just go around the circle and each of us talk about something that we've seen or a trend that we've seen that's interesting, scary, bad, good, whatever.
Dunk Stop. City.
Dunk City. I'm rolling with Dunk City and the guys from LaSalle. They've been fun to watch, and I was not that surprised. I actually did pick them to get through to the Sweet 16 in my bracket. It's on Local 12, so you can check that out to see if I'm lying or not.
I mean, you're Brian. Probably lying, but that's really irrelevant. Stop calling charges. Just stop. It's ridiculous.
Snow, are you a fan of the charge, the block charge?
It is turned into the most ridiculous thing ever. Like, to even pretend that Aaron Kraft was in any way playing defense on Will Clyburn, in any way, the only thing he affected that Will Clyburn did was land. That's not playing defense. That's being a parking cone. And if you are a parking cone, you are not guarding anybody. It's absolutely asinine. And then I saw something I never thought I'd see, a flagrant foul issued to a guy dribbling the basketball. Nearly impossible to happen, but they managed to do it with this unbelievable flagrant foul rule. I mean, I'm not sure what they want, if they want like elbows to just not exist on the human body, but something's got to be done about those two rules because they are both awful and they are ruining the game.
And keep in mind that Snow was the SID for that All-Ohio team led by Aaron Kraft back in the day. So that's tough for him to admit, but he's absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean,
the other,
it is what it is. Those are my homies, but he wasn't playing defense. He was a parking cone.
Talking about the flagrant one, the one I mean, it's so remarkable that the foul that was called on McDermott at the end of the Creighton UC game, that there was literally unanimity, everybody on the postgame show, the announcers, all the commentators on ESPN after the fact, all of them said the same thing. They said, oh, it's a good call, but the rule is stupid. What are we doing? I mean, honestly, what are we doing? If what's his name, Kramer from Purdue, hadn't got his face rearranged by Manny Harris a few years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And that's another pretty good reason to dislike that Purdue team, as far as I'm concerned. For me, the big thing that I saw, I thought that I have to agree with you, Rick, is that lost in all the justifiable hubbub about Florida Gulf Coast is how well LaSalle's played this week. And I tweeted this earlier this week, but it was just over two years ago, down at Cintas Center, when Xavier was leading LaSalle 41-8 with about 8 minutes left in the first half of the game there. And Eric Murray and Dr. G were getting basically into a verbal brawl on the LaSalle bench. And that was a team in complete and utter disarray at that point, a program in utter disarray. I figured at that point that Dr. John may not survive that offseason. I thought he may get the axe. As it turned out, it was Eric Murray that left. He's Bob Huggins' problem now. And just a couple years later, the LaSalle Explorers are in the Sweet 16. So kudos to them. What a great turnaround.
Absolutely. Well, that does it for this segment of the podcast. Snow, appreciate you as always coming on the podcast and for doing that all year long. And I know the people appreciate you as well. And I'm sure we will talk plenty this spring with recruiting when that gets underway. So thanks for coming on all year.
It is an honor to be a part of the Willie Mopena edition. It has absolutely no bearing on me that I'm associated with you guys.
All right. Well, he's been on the podcast one other time already, Dan, and he killed it the first time. So back by popular demand, we've brought Mario Mercurio back on the podcast. Mario, thanks for joining us once again.
Guys, I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
All right. Well, let's get right into it. Tons has been going on over there on Dana and Victory. Let's start with the conference change. Just talk a little bit about the excitement and sort of what this means for the basketball program going into the Big East. What's the buzz around the Cintas Center offices, and what's being said about this right now?
You know, no different than probably the message boards on your site, and that's just absolute excitement. You know, some people have been waiting for this day for a decade. Other people didn't even acknowledge it was going to happen until a couple months ago. I would be one of the latter. You know, I always thought about it, and you know, in terms of a fantasy that may one day happen. But you know, as you saw the chips kind of fall over the last couple months, you know, you really start to realize, man, this can happen. And as it starts to happen so quickly that you literally go from the speculative stage all the way to the day when you're sitting on the third floor in Cintas Center, seeing the webcast of Father Graham and seeing those other nine logos up there with you, along with the Big East logo. It's an amazing deal.
Mario, can you tell us about what your understanding is regarding the postseason tournament for the Big East? Because there's a lot of brand equity in both the Big East name, but also in the conference tournament. What's your understanding of how that's going to proceed in the coming years?
You know, Dan, obviously a lot still has to be ironed out. The head coaches are meeting for the first time as a group at the Final Four, which should be a unique event. With respect to the conference tournament, you know, the last time I was in Madison Square Gardens, Xavier was playing Mississippi State, David West, I believe senior year. We lost that game. It was a part of a 3-year deal with Mississippi State. Mario Austin returned from injury. Of course, it was his first game back. I believe he had a double-double and crushed us. That was my last memory. I think it was 10 or 11 years ago, Madison Square Garden. So it'll be awesome to return to that. I was actually, and the guys at UC were nice enough to give me a ticket. I was going to go to the Providence UC game this year, but our flight wound up getting delayed, and I didn't get to check it out. But I didn't want to sneak over this year and kind of get a feel for it. And everyone's always talked about with respect to that event have always been awesome. It'll be incredible to be a part of that, especially when you consider the nine teams we'll be in there with.
Mario, just talk a little bit. You know, we talked last time so much about scheduling, and you gave us some great answers there and really gave us an insight into talking about the flow of things and how you sort of go about scheduling. With the change of conferences, obviously the A-10 was probably underrated this year as a conference, and you played some really tough conference games as it was this season. But moving into the Big East, how much does that change the way you look at scheduling? I mean, do you have to go a little lighter non-conference now?
You know, I got to be honest, a lot changes. And an interesting part of this whole deal is this time last week, I had no idea if we were going to be playing 16 or 18 games in our conference season. You know, obviously 18 is the number that's emerged as the official answer. So from there, you got to look at your non-conference portion of your schedule being cut by two. So last year and all the years prior, we were scheduling 11 games on our own plus an exempt event. Next year, we're down to 9 games plus an exempt event. And the question you really have to ask when you look at how you make those non-conference decisions is how many high major games are we going to play in a year? And you could argue when you look at the 16-game slate from the A-10, how many of those you would call high major type games. I'll keep my number private, but conjure up in your head whatever that number might be. You take that number and you look last year, we played 6 high major series in the non-conference. We play UC at a neutral site game. And then you play a high major exempt event, so 3 more high major type games. So if you take that number of what you were saying in the A-10 and add into that 10 from the non-conference, that's how many high major type games we were playing. Now, when I look at next year, you have an 18-game conference schedule. I know there's some people that like to insist that the bottom feeders of our conference are, you know, not high major type teams. I would very strongly disagree with that. I think if you look at any of the teams in this conference, even if their record isn't one that's getting to the NIT, getting the NCAA, they have high major talent. And when you couple those games in with the fact that you're going to be coming off a brutal stretch before or heading into a brutal stretch after, I'm calling all 18 of those games high major type games. So you take that 18 and you say you have 9 games left to schedule plus your exempt event. Now, with those 9, we're in a 10-year deal with Wake Forest. You're down to 8. You have UC at U.S. Bank Arena. You're down to 7. So really, you have 7 decisions left to make about how tough of an opponent, where are you going to play that team, you know, and what you're trying to accomplish with those 7 games. You know, going back to that archaic math we were just talking about there, if you take those 18 high major games in conference and you only whack 2 guaranteed games and say, I'm going to stick with that high major, the 6 high major series, I'm going to stick with UC, and we're going to stick with that exempt event, we would play 28 out of 30 games against high major teams. I would tell you that I think we're going to have a great team next year. I think Coach Mack does a phenomenal job, but I think any team would struggle doing that, you know? So what you got to figure out is just the balance in your decision-making in terms of not losing that non-conference goal of building a bid, building a seed, scheduling for a seed, and also understanding that I've been a Xavier here a long time, and you guys have been Xavier fans for a long time. November and December for Xavier is very special. You know, at other places in SEC country and in the Pac-12, I know everybody's tailgating and excited about football, and you're kind of watching that BCS, and next thing you know, oh, it's January, it's time to maybe start showing up at those basketball games. At Xavier, you know, that second Friday of December is like Christmas, you know. Circled for quite some time, and you know, I think Coach Mack and everybody in Xavier knows that we can't roll out a schedule with 8 guarantee games. You go downtown and you play UC, you disappear for a week in a tropical location and play an exempt event. So to answer your question, after all that, I do think you'll see with those 7 games that are kind of left in terms of our decision making, I think you'll probably see the 6 series against high major teams probably turn into 4. I think, as I talked about playing 28 of 30 games against high major type opponents, I think that number probably is a healthier number if it's 24, 25, 26. That gives you opportunities to play those teams at home that you strategically schedule. You're not gonna get a 300 level RPI team, but kind of a recognizable guarantee game that still challenges your team, but you know that you're at home. You know, if you put the effort in scouting wise and know what you guys are doing, that you should come away, God willing, with a win.
Mario, 2 questions for you. First of all, you talked about the 9 games you can choose this year. I know that you've got UC at a neutral site. You mentioned Wake at home. I think you've got a return game from Tennessee this year that would also be at home. Do you have any of those other slots filled yet that you can let us in on, or is it too early to say?
UC at U.S. Bank Arena, you're correct in that. We are going to play Miami, Ohio at home. We are going to play Gardner-Webb in our home opener on the second Friday. The first Tuesday of our season, and this is something we haven't released yet, but I'll give it to you guys tonight. We are going to play Tennessee in the marathon at Cintas Center. ESPN was blown away with what we were able to put together for a 4 o'clock game yesterday. I think, as I told you on the last podcast, like, that is a really cool event, and God willing, people are able to pick it up in their offices all across the country, and you see Xavier and you hear about Xavier the days leading into that event. They've invited us to return to be a part of that. We're going to play Tennessee, and I believe the slot is going to be 3 o'clock. So ask for your half days now. We've got a guaranteed contract with Morehead State. We're close to finalizing a deal with Northwestern. That series will start at Northwestern. And then, as you mentioned, we have Wake at home.
And playing off that, you talked about the exempt event, and you've been very aggressive. Xavier's been very aggressive about scheduling the exempt events in the past. There is a rule, I believe an NCAA rule, that says that 2 teams from the same conference cannot participate in the same event. Now, this Atlantis tournament that's coming up this coming season, Villanova's also also scheduled to play. So first question is that an issue? Will that be an issue for future tournaments, including that Nike event in Oregon? And the second thing is there any – I think that there are a couple teams that are already on the schedule that are also playing in that Atlantis tournament. Tennessee and Wake Forest come to mind. Will the tournament organizers try to keep X separate from those teams so to avoid rematches from other regular season games?
You know, the first thing I'll say is just your question earlier about exempt events. You know, the thing about our scheduling philosophy with exempt events, I think that'll be one of the things that we bring with us as we head to this new conference. You know, I think we're getting a little culture shock in terms of the 18-game slate, you know, the number of high major teams we're going to play. But we've kind of conditioned ourselves to play in those three-game events, you know, usually in a nice tropical location. You'll see other teams from these power conferences that will host two games and then go to Madison Square or Barclays or, you know, wherever it may be and play another two-game part of that exempt event. I don't foresee us doing that anytime soon. I think getting in a tournament setting early, getting your guys in a forum where, let's say you lose that first game, which unfortunately we've done a couple times here in the last couple years, getting a guy to learn how to turn the page quickly, you know, to deal with adversity, to understand you got a game the next day, a quick scouting turnaround. I think those are all things that you get from those 3 games in 4 days type neutral site tournament. So I think those will still be a big part of what we do. With regards to Atlantis, you are right in the fact that Villanova is in there, Tennessee is in there, and Wake is in there. That's an event that we committed to a long time ago. I really believe it's going to be the premier event in terms of exempt events in college basketball. This will be its, whether you want to say second or third year, they've kind of rebranded and kind of changed their format a little bit. But the lady who runs that event, Lee Miller, has traveled to every corner of the country dealing with teams from every conference, and she's done an amazing job. Their slate this year, next year, and the following year are unbelievable. So we as we started to schedule those series as of Wake and, you know, the Tennessee or the Wake series kind of returned, we realized what was happening. We had requested to be on the other side of the bracket from Tennessee and Wake. Now with us partnering with Villanova in the same conference, we basically requested the same thing. So we're shifting all those guys to the other half of the bracket, which, God willing, can happen. We filed a waiver with the NCAA for not only this year, but as crazy as it is, next year and the following year, there's overlap with current Big East teams as well. You know, with the amount of changes going on, Louisville from the Big East to the ACC, Pitt and Syracuse to the ACC, you know, the combination of the leftover Big East schools, you know, some Conference USA schools, the amount of changes that have taken place, as you guys know, are well documented. I think those problems are going to be rampant over the course of these events for years to come. And, God willing, they're in a position to where maybe they do a blanket waiver for the next couple of years. Whether they opt to do that or not is, you know, above my pay grade. If not, I think that because of the date the contracts have all been signed, we'll have an opportunity to hopefully stay in those events and just be positioned on the other side of the bracket. You know, especially with next year and the following year, knowing that you're going to play, and, you know, I believe the two teams we overlap with in the upcoming years are Marquette and Seton Hall. To think about having to play those teams 3 times is something you'd really, really like to avoid if you can do it. But it's not as simple, especially when you deal with those ESPN events of saying, all right, you know, the guy who does it, his name's Pete Derzis. He handles all their bowl games. You know, Pete, pop us over into that Old Spice, you know, rather than go to Puerto Rico, can we go to Charleston that year? There's overlap everywhere you look. You know, there's only so many teams in each conference. You know, they design each field by taking one team from each conference, so they're usually spread out way years in advance. So there's a lot of roadblocks in terms of even shifting. So we'll see how that pans out. Our intention would be to stay with it and get positioned away from those teams. Your final question was about the Nike event, and that one obviously is a monster. You know, 16 teams. At the time it was scheduled, it was us and Butler representing the Atlantic 10. Now, clearly, Xavier Butler in the Big East. I think we're all smart enough to know there's some big Nike schools that are already in the Big East, and how they'll do that at this point has not been decided. And again, as we talked about, some of those schools that have moved conferences, you know, Syracuse, I'm sure they feel like they deserve to be in that event, and they probably do. Well, you're now in a conference with Duke and Carolina. You know, who's going to be the top two they pick? I would hate to be the one that deals with the ramifications of that decision, you know.
Without question. Great stuff right there. Mario, going back to, you know, you mentioned some of those bye games. I mean, I'm just going to come out and ask what everyone else who's listening to this is wondering. At this point, does Dayton just qualify as a guarantee game at home? I mean, could they possibly be one of those?
You know, I know fans don't like to hear this. We have a great relationship with the Dayton staff. I do not know what's going to happen right now with that Dayton game. I think it's safe to say this coming year it will be a struggle to schedule that game, regardless of if it's played at Dayton, at Xavier. You know, I've heard suggestions of it being played at Indianapolis, wherever it may be. I just think from the numbers crunch on our end, the fact that, as we talked about, having only basically seven scheduling opportunities left, some of which are already gone, as I mentioned, Morehead State, Gardner Webb, you know, Miami, Ohio at home, at Northwestern, we're really down to probably needing only two games. I do think it's going to be tough to fill those guys in next year. I think, again, as I mentioned to you guys last time, other rivalries in the A-10, and this isn't being said to diminish what we had against Dayton, are also in consideration to be continued. You know, you look at St. Joe's, you look at Temple, they're in Philadelphia, an area we really, really have earmarked as a great spot for us recruiting-wise. You can't have them all, you know, and you have to really value where the desire to play Dayton and how that fits in with our model. How that overweighs or doesn't something like playing at Temple in a home-and-home series. So to answer your question, I do believe they'd be above bye game status, Rick.
and then real quick, I know you're going to play the Cincinnati series this year. I know it's TBD as far as what goes on with that. Does moving to the Big East and them being sort of left in limbo right now change the way you view that rivalry at all?
You know, you're asking me, and I'll represent what my opinion is. There's obviously a lot of other people with this, you know, with their own opinions. I'm from Cincinnati. I can't imagine that game going away, regardless of the name of the conference that UC's in, the fact that we're in the Big East, the fact that we were in the A-10 and they were in the Big East. I think all that stuff is secondary to the fact that when you strip it all down, when you forget about what happened last year and you think about the games over the last 12 and 15 years between those two teams, that is honestly one of college sports' best rivalries. And not playing that game, in my opinion, again, this is not the paid for by Xavier opinion, but as a Cincinnati sports fan, I think would be a travesty. I can assure you there is no backdoor agendas on either end. You know, I don't feel like they're lobbying for one thing and we're lobbying for another. You know, I think I would feel a lot better about U.S. Bank last year. You know, the whole setting down there, had we won, you know, it's really tough when you lose a game. You look back and say, man, what an awesome environment. I do remember when we were up, it felt like an awesome environment. And I'm sure if we won, I'd be singing its praises right now. But, you know, I think if this is a city that can embrace that, if you can get in there and, it's half blue, half red. I think that's something that can be a part of what we do forever. You know, if we go down there this year and you look up and it feels like the excitement for that game at a neutral site has diminished a little bit, you know, do you look at bringing it back to the campuses? And again, that'll be a decision made by people other than the guy you're talking to right here. But if I had anything to say, I would say that it'd be great to keep that deal going.
Hey, Mario, one more scheduling question for you, and that's we know that obviously the Big East will be on Fox Sports 1 for the most part. That'll be the TV, the conference TV deal for next year and going deep into the future. What can XU fans expect as far as the TV situation next year for non-conference games and for the scheduling of those conference games as far as days of the week? Do you have any insight into that at this point?
With the non-conference, usually the home team is going to be the team that has the rights to that game. So what by that I mean when we go play at Northwestern, the Big Ten's hierarchy of scheduling is in effect. So if the Big Ten works where the ESPN family networks pick the top 60 Big Ten non-conference games, and then the next 20 go to the Big Ten network, whatever that may be, that'll be in effect regardless of the conference, regardless of the opponent, anytime we're on the road. If you're at a case when you go on the road and you've seen this before and that team says, you know what, we don't have any, you know, nobody wants this game, you know, then we usually ask Fox Sports to come with us. And that's always been a great asset that we've had. For home games, I honestly can't speak to what that situation will be. I know, fortunately, and sometimes it's harder to find the games than it has been in the past, that, you know, 147 of the last 150 Xavier games have been on TV and available nationally, which is an unbelievable number. You know, as we move to Fox, I would hope that, you know, the Fox brand and the Fox Sports Regional, Fox Sports Ohio, all that would work together. But I'm honestly speaking out of turn. I have high hopes based on the amount of assets they allocated towards that contract to say that I don't think anything will be done to keep us off TV. I think that our television situation will be better than ever.
Mario, this may be an unfair question to ask you, especially at this point, but can you fill us in at all on your understanding of the possibilities of expanding the Big East? I mean, we know there's been plenty of rumors about going to 12. Do you know if there's any type of rumbling about that happening next year or potentially in the future?
I don't. You know, I that's one of the things, I'll be very truthful. I read the same stuff that you guys do. You know, as I mentioned, next week the head coaches are gathering in Atlanta. You know, is that going to be a part of their discussion? I'm not sure. You know, I know that there's a lot of different hands in the pot, presidents, athletic directors, coaches, the television end. You know, I'm not sure what direction is going to win out, how fast of a pace it'll be in terms of its growth. Do they see other conference situations kind of taking shape that allow them to kind of feel comfortable as they are right now and maybe wait on a couple different teams that they think they could get if different teams shake out? I'm not certain about that at all. You know, from a basketball standpoint, when you look at having 10 teams, there's a lot of positives to that. You know, as we talked about, an 18-game true double round robin, I think you look at those 10 teams and say, those are all teams that can go to the NCAA tournament. They're all in large cities for the most part. They're going to have a chance to, you know, win each and every year. Their resources are allocated in the right places. I think that you could look at those 10 and say, man, we don't want to screw this up by making the wrong choice. It'll be interesting to see what other agendas are out there and what other areas they feel can benefit from having 12 teams, 14 teams, whatever it may be.
Mario, a pleasure having you on the show again today. I think you gave us some – I think that certainly that ESPN tip-off information is an absolute world premiere on this podcast, so we really appreciate your time.
I'm happy to do it.
Thanks a lot, Mario.
Okay, so great stuff from Mario, mediocre stuff from Snow. That's pretty typical for what we get on the show. So, Rick, I think at this point we have hit about the one-year mark for this podcast, you know, give or take a few weeks. You know, we've reached a point, I think it's been a nice critical mass. I mean, lots of people are listening to the show. You see the statistics. There's a lot of interest in the podcast, and we really appreciate everybody for tuning in, making us a part of your commute or gym workout or whatever. Sometimes we rant. Sometimes we have good information, not that often. Sometimes we just fill the air with BS, but we're really happy to keep doing this. And let us know. You know, we always like to hear feedback from the folks that listen to the podcast about how we can make it better for next year. I'm sure we'll continue to have some of the same stable of regular guests on the show, Mario, Brian Snow. We'll try and get B. Lark and Andy Mack back on next year and maybe expand the universe a little bit. But any feedback or suggestions or thoughts or concerns that you want to share with us, feel free to either post them on the message board, email Rick, email me, tweet at either one of us, etc. We appreciate it.
Yep, well, that does it for the Willie Mo Pena. If nothing else, Snow didn't contribute a whole heck of a lot this entire podcast season. But if nothing else, he contributed the William O'Pena edition, and I appreciate that.
That's true. Oh, and one last thing that I was going to say is that probably expect us to go back into off-season mode. So you're probably looking at a new episode every 2 or 3 weeks, depending on what news breaks. So
right.
We won't be on the every week schedule that we've been following since December.
But with that being said, this is, as hopefully most of you will agree, sort of the best time of year to subscribe to this site. This is what it's about, is the recruiting. The recruited season kicks off here soon. I'll be out on the road, and we'll be updating all the guys that Xavier's tracking, who the coaches are watching. We'll be talking to Snow, Evan Daniels, Josh Gershon, and, of course, I'll be out there. So we'll have plenty of recruiting updates, and be sure to share that along with your friends. This is probably the best time to sign up for the site right after the season ends. You wouldn't necessarily expect that with it being a college basketball site, but it's mostly about the recruiting information here. So hopefully you enjoy that for all you new subscribers that we've added recently. And like Dan said, we will be bringing this podcast to you once every 2 or 3 weeks. And that does it for the Willie Mopena edition of the Dane of Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.